This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Eggland's Best.
I'm Stacy Lynn. With the ceasefire over, Israeli defense forces are blowing up tunnels in Gaza. They're attacking with full force on the ground and from the air. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says Israel must protect civilians in Gaza.
I have repeatedly made clear to Israel's leaders that protecting Palestinian civilians in Gaza is both a moral responsibility and a strategic imperative.
On CNN this morning, Senator Lindsey Graham.
I think the goal of destroying Hamas is important for Israel, really important for the Palestinians. And Hamas is making it impossible for Israel to fight without hurting innocent people.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu called the ground operation necessary and says the war will continue until Israel achieves its goals. Bill Gates is at the climate summit in Dubai and says it is uber important that the government fully commit to achieving the transition to net zero.
We need a commitment to make this transition, not some of the time we care and some of the time we don't.
At the summit, the Biden administration laid out rules to cut millions of tons of methane emissions. Snow is expected in New England the next 2 days. The weather story in the Pacific Northwest says National Weather Service meteorologist Bob Orovac. It's still wet, but
a lot of heavy rain expected. The snow levels are rising, so it looks like there's only going to be some heavy snow potential across the higher elevations of the Cascades of Washington and Oregon. The biggest impact from this event will be the heavy rains across parts of Oregon and Washington.
Violent night in Queens, New York. Here's WCBS-TV reporter Christina Pham.
Three people are dead. Three others are in critical condition, and two officers were also slashed while responding. And to add to the chaos, the home they responded to was on fire, and the FDNY had to be called in to put it out.
The suspect is also dead. Tonight in Washington, the Kennedy Center is commemorating some big names and their lifetime achievement in arts and entertainment, like comedian Billy Crystal.
Mama. You look marvelous.
Queen Latifah gets the nod.
If you want to cross the bridge, my sweet, you've got to pay the toll.
As well as opera singer Renee Fleming. The Bee Gees' Barry Gibb. And Dionne Warwick.
I say a little prayer for you.
President Biden is hosting the honorees at the White House later this afternoon. And then with the First Lady, they will both attend the program tonight. This is CBS News.
Eggland's Best, the only eggs with more fresh and delicious taste, plus superior nutrition, because the way we care is anything but ordinary. Only Eggland's Best.
I'm Tamron Hall. Eggs on.
Lexi spent more than 6 years in foster care.
Before I was adopted, I felt alone.
With help from the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption, Lexi now has a forever family and the foundation for a bright future.
Adoption changed me.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Dow. Farmers and people who live in flood-prone communities are looking to policymakers to improve the health of Wisconsin's soil. Mike Moen has more.
Congress will soon renew debate over long-term farm bill funding, including incentives for producers to adopt practices like no-till farming, which allow the soil to hold more water after heavy rain. Julio Badinsky is a consultant for the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute and says this isn't just an issue for farmers and policymakers. She says taxpayer dollars come into play when these programs are underfunded.
Some of the costs that they pay because of the lack of investment in soil health practices, especially municipalities, rural communities, even state budgets, when they're looking at costs to repair flooding damages.
Between 2009 and 2019, Wisconsin suffered nearly $36 million in flood damage. On the flip side, she says soil health investment and improved water quality pay off for communities, such as boosting home values along watersheds. These discussions also follow recent conservation funding boosts from the Inflation Reduction Act, with advocates noting they're poised to help more rural areas. South Central Wisconsin farmer Ron Shemp is among those who have tapped into IRA incentives this year through the Federal Conservation Stewardship Program, providing benefits that reach beyond his property.
We farm right on Lake Wisconsin, and so there's less runoff, and so that definitely helps the neighbors by keeping a cleaner Lake Wisconsin.
He also contends that making these incentives more accessible could place less stress on disaster aid programs for farmers. Congress has until next fall to adopt a new farm bill after extending the recent version for another year. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. No chances for today should be light. Could have a little bit of light rain mixed in with it as well. Any kind of accumulation, if you see it, will be well under an inch. Clouds at upper 30s later in the afternoon. For the overnight, mostly cloudy and upper 20s. It's 33 at our studios.
On air, 93.5 FM. Online, thetap.com. And on the Civic Media app. This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
AUK. Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. This is Jim Santel. This is our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you for joining me and my wonderful producer, Greg, here in the studios of the Civic Media outlets throughout the state of Wisconsin. Thank you for spending some time with us in this, our second hour of the broadcast, talking as we always do about the aspiration for justice in America, law, government, issues and animating our lives, our livelihoods. And speaking this morning about some updates coming out of our federal courts, our state courts as well, having to do with the major pieces of litigation pending in those courts. Right before the top of the hour break, talking about a major decision issued by Judge Tanya Chutkan. She is a federal district court judge in the District of Columbia. She is presiding over what will be a trial in March of next year. That's when she is scheduled the trial of this very, very important major indictment charging Donald Trump with four different counts of election interference, that being prosecuted by the U.S. Department of Justice and Jack Smith, who, of course, is the special counsel there. She has before her this request by the defense to dismiss the case based upon the notion, the doctrine, the argument that Donald Trump, by virtue of his status as the president, was immune from any sort of criminal prosecution like this. Judge Tanya Chutkan just this past week recognizing that she is obliged to respond in these pretrial periods to those kinds of motions, basically saying these arguments are not valid at all, rejecting those, saying that indeed he is not immune from criminal prosecution. Along the way, saying some very important things about the rule of law generally when it comes to any president, any person in the federal district court. In a ruling, Judge Chutkan said that the office of the presidency does not confer a lifelong, as she described it, get out of jail free pass. That's what she writes in her omnibus order, dismissing this notion that there is immunity that attaches to the former president. She said former presidents enjoy no special conditions on their federal criminal liability. This defendant may be subject to federal investigation, indictment, prosecution, conviction, and punishment for any criminal acts undertaken while in office. And she's probably referencing there the notion that, again, there is this internal memorandum inside the Department of Justice that says when there is a sitting president that person, whoever that person may be, not subject as a policy matter, not a legislative matter, not a judicial finding, that indeed there should be some consideration for the presidency during the time in office. But she's saying that this defendant can, in fact, be subject to criminal prosecution for the things that he did when he's out of office now. That's Tanya Chutkan's great statement about the rule of law just this past week. She also rejected Trump's claims that this indictment somehow violates his rights under the Constitution generally, his free speech rights, his First Amendment rights, obviously especially important at a time when he is out there campaigning for the presidency. We know that with respect to that matter, the case that is the challenge to her imposition of a so-called gag order, restrictive order, that's pending before the D.C. Court of Appeals, just like the case involving the New York judge, Judge Engoron, actually referred to as Justice Engoron. He presides in the Superior Court there. That's the way they describe them in New York. That particular case has its parallel in the federal system. Judge Chutkan's similar order directing that this defendant not, in fact, engage in the kinds of incendiary statements that he has made in the past. That's also pending right now before the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia, the federal court. And it sounded from the oral argument of a couple of weeks ago that the Court of Appeals is probably going to affirm that lower court order, but also saying along the way that there may be some accommodations that can be made under the First Amendment that do not implicate and do not affect the conduct of the trial before Judge Chutkan. The court in Judge Chutkan's ruling on the immunity issue, this major petition for dismissal, also said it is well established that the First Amendment does not protect speech that is used as an instrument of crime. That's what she said just this past week. The defendant is not being prosecuted simply for making false statements, but rather for knowingly making false statements in furtherance of a criminal conspiracy and obstructing the electoral process. That's what Judge Chutkan wrote in dismissing this notion that the case should be dismissed based upon immunity principles. All of this happening at the same time that the D.C. Court of Appeals, same venue, different court, higher court, addressed also in an order just issued yesterday, a somewhat similar situation, a somewhat similar set of doctrines about whether or not there is immunity. This one having to do with some civil lawsuits have been brought by House Democrats in the House of Representatives, and some officers who were involved in trying to protect our Capitol on January 6th. And in particular, they allege that they were injured in that riot. They have brought a civil lawsuit in federal court, as have others in the federal court, alleging that Donald Trump is responsible for the injuries that they suffered, both as members of Congress and these particular officers as well, and that his conduct is directly attributable to the kinds of injuries that they suffered, that he should be held, according to the complaint, the civil complaint in those cases, accountable for his conduct in inciting the riot that caused this disruption. More than 2 years later, these cases continue to percolate up and around. And as a result of that, the appeals court addressing whether or not those civil cases should be permitted to go ahead, be tried in a district court, the district court in District of Columbia, just yesterday issued a major order. This, again, the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia, basically knocking down Donald Trump's very sweeping claims that presidential immunity, again, the same concept in this civil environment, somehow shields him from liability in these civil lawsuits brought by the lawmakers, the legislators, the Democrats in Congress, and also these police officers. The three-judge panel that made this decision, again, permitting the lawsuit to go ahead, also said that he can continue to fight in this trial. He can continue to present evidence, doesn't shut him down entirely. But just that the notion of immunity, at least at this stage in the proceedings, is not a bar to the case going ahead. Trump had said that he can't be sued over his role, whatever that may have been in the riot, because of these are matters of public concern, that, again, he is immune from this kind of prosecution, and that he has absolute presidential immunity. The Court of Appeals, like Judge Tanya Chutkan, the lower court in the criminal case, just yesterday finding just the opposite, rejecting what Donald Trump and his lawyers have said and telling him that, indeed, the case will go ahead. The principal judge of the three-judge panel wrote this. He said, he is acting as an office seeker, not an office holder. no less than are the persons running against him when they take precisely the same actions in their competing campaigns to attain precisely the same office. In other words, he is serving in a campaign role there, not doing anything in the scope of his actual duties and responsibilities. And for that reason, immunity does not attach. Some major cases coming out of state and federal district and appeals courts just in recent days affecting the future of those prosecutions and permitting them to go ahead and affirming them, at least as to the federal case in front of Judge Chutkan, this fundamental notion and also the civil case that the immunity doctrine that does apply in some instances does not apply here when the defendant is not acting in the scope of his official duties and responsibilities, but serving simply as a campaign advocate for his own candidacy for the presidency. An important concept. No one is above the law. That's what the courts are saying. We always appreciate your calls, your comments, and indeed, we've got a caller this morning, Dana from La Crosse. Appreciate your calling in this morning to be a part of our discussion. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning, Jim. Thanks for taking my call. It's been a while.
Glad to have you with us, Dana, right?
You betcha. Rest assured, I'm still listening every weekend.
Wonderful.
It's just a great show. I think the time slot you have here, this is definitely the best thing available on any airwaves. And I hope you're getting more and more listeners to discover you every weekend.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Spread the word. We always appreciate also your calling in and with comments and questions.
You betcha. I'd like to visit the gag order issue. So we all know what he's up to with all his tweets and his attacks on basically anybody involved with any of these trials, and then down to their wives and everything. It's just incredible. And then whining about, and he's got his surrogates doing the same about how he's being persecuted and not being allowed to, you know, discuss the trials and everything to defend himself publicly. When we all know, you know, those of us that aren't enamored with his dazzling personality, we all know that he's been given more leeway than anybody in this country would ever be given, and definitely a two-tiered system there, but not in the way they want to define it. What I am wondering, Jim, is a possible scenario that I think could happen, and let's say the trial doesn't end up the way we are all hoping and thinking it definitely should. And it is found that he did have an effect on witnesses or other people involved with the court, and it did alter the outcome. So in most cases, in the justice system, people can appeal. Can the people appeal or sue and ask for a do-over?
Right.
Or any implications?
Sure. What is the remedy? Right. What is, regardless of what the result is, right? And Dana, I'm going to have you stay on the line because I'm going to take a break right now, and then I'm going to come back and address your question right after this break. A great thought, a great question this morning. What happens?
Jim, I'll take you off the air.
Wonderful. Dana, thanks for calling in. We'll take that up right after this break.
When it's cold outside, I've got the month of May.
The Tap.
One in four Americans today are living with a disability. I'm one of them. People with disabilities are extremely talented, resilient problem solvers that have so much to offer. And we've got a trusted ally on our side, an organization we can rely on, Easter Seals. Easter Seals is leading the way to full equity, inclusion, and access to healthcare, employment, and education for people with disabilities, families, and communities. That's my Easter Seals. Make it yours.
Learn more and get involved at EasterSeals.com.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight.
The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Back here on our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you for joining me and my terrific producer, Greg, this morning here on Civic Media, the stations throughout the state of Wisconsin. We're talking about many things this morning, including the Supreme Court. We're going to get back to that in our final segments of this hour. Right before the break, taking this wonderful question from Dana, who's calling in from La Crosse, asking about the consequences of someone, any defendant out there, who would undermine the systems of justice by having an impact, for example, upon the witnesses, having an impact upon members of the jury, having an impact upon the actual result in the trial. What if it goes in a direction, either conviction or non-conviction? What if there is some strong sense that indeed the statements made did in fact implicate issues related to the legitimacy of the proceedings themselves prompted witnesses not to testify as they otherwise would have, prompted a jury pool to be jaded in some way. And again, Dana, you've identified in so many ways what is animating all of these attempts by the judges to shut down these kinds of inappropriate comments inside and outside the courtroom related to the legitimacy of those proceedings. And I have always said, and I think what you're going to see coming out of the Court of Appeals in just Columbia, certainly coming out of the appeals court in the state of New York just this past week, that yes, indeed, someone like Donald Trump does have First Amendment rights. Every defendant, state or federal system, also has a First Amendment right to speak. What do you have a right to speak about when it comes to the prosecution, a criminal prosecution, I would add even a civil piece of legislation? You can say general things like, I am not liable. I am not guilty. I am not the one who did the things that are alleged in the indictment. You can even go further and ascribe some bad motive, if you want, to the prosecution itself, civil or criminal. When I was U.S. attorney, it wasn't unusual for, it was atypical, but sometimes happened that you got criticism for the very bringing of the lawsuit. And that comes with the job. What is not appropriate is commenting on the specific witnesses and commenting about their legitimacy, their credibility, the kinds of things that could, in fact, implicate, again, what they're going to say during the course of the trial, could have a chilling effect. We've seen that with Donald Trump before when he not only dangles pardons in front of some people when he is president, but also suggests outright that they should testify in certain ways. That's called witness tampering. And to answer your question in part, Dana, if in fact, and these are difficult cases to prove, if in fact you can draw that direct line between things that are said regardless of the outcome of the trial, and a witness comes forward and says, I have been intimidated, I have been threatened, which regrettably would be the most compelling case of all, I've been threatened by this defendant. That in itself, that's obstruction of justice. That could be the source of a separate criminal prosecution. Not easy to show, right? Especially when you've got statements of the kind that Donald Trump is making. It is much more difficult, of course, to show that these kinds of things affect the jury pool, the people called in, what's called the veneer generally, from whom a jury is selected. Much more difficult to show that somehow you've infected that process. But that's the reason why these judges, these justices, are looking at all this and saying that as they attempt to both balance the interests of the defendant, Donald Trump, and being able to speak about on the campaign trail in other settings about what he thinks is the unfair prosecution against the legitimacy of the trial proceeding itself. When you balance those things, there's a line that can be drawn, and it can be drawn very clearly. And as Justice or Judge Engoron says, those things can be enforced. And some of the remedies include, of course, depending upon whether there's civil or criminal contempt, they can include fines. They can include the imprisonment if, in fact, you've committed that contempt in the presence of the court. Could be a separate proceeding. All sorts of procedures go along with these kinds of things. But there are remedies. There are remedies both internal to the proceedings as they're being conducted and also after them. It's not easy. It's not easy. But in fact, there are things that can be done. The point right now is these judges doing all kinds of things to ensure that the trials as they go ahead do not bring into the courtroom the effects of these statements, that the witnesses are not intimidated, that you do not have threats that are visited upon them, that the juries, when they do come in, can in fact set aside whatever views they have and make determinations based upon what they see in the four corners of the courtroom. Those are the questions to be asked of these jurors in these criminal and indeed civil cases as they go forward in the times ahead. Great question. Remedies, not always easy. Not always accessible immediately, but available out there, depending upon what happens here. Final comment about your very good comment, Dana, and that is that, yes, indeed, to the extent that Donald Trump maintains that he is being treated unfairly, indeed, just the opposite. You commented along the way that he's been given an awful lot of leeway. Indeed, he has. I will tell you from my own experience, 30 years as a criminal prosecutor, civil litigator as well, in the federal, civil, and criminal courts, if defendants, and specifically if other attorneys, if any parties, even witnesses engaged in this kind of behavior, they would be before the court and there would be sanctions imposed. These judges are plainly giving him a very, very broad scope of activity in which to engage because they recognize that he is indeed a candidate. Whether that should be a consideration is one of those things that reasonable people can differ on. Judge Chutkin, other judges have said that you have no greater or lesser status than any other defendant. And if that is the case, if that is the truth, then when it comes to violating these so-called gag orders, these restrictive orders, they should be subject to the same kinds of penalties that any other defendant would be facing in the federal district courts here in Wisconsin, the state courts here in Wisconsin, and throughout the United States of America. Many, many important things out there to chat about. We'll continue to be on top of all those things. Lots of things coming up in 2024, including, once again, according to Judge Chutkin, as late as this past week, the initiation, the start of that criminal trial in her courtroom. Other cases in New York, other cases in Georgia. Also, just this past week, the subject of some hearings in front of Judge Scott McAfee, who's the state court judge there in Georgia, presiding over that omnibus, many, many pages of indictments, 19 defendants, 15 still viable defendants, and wrestling with this question of when this case goes to trial. Lots of interesting discussion coming out of that hearing just this past week. Not a clear trial date set yet for Georgia, but probably that one among all the trials going ahead, probably the last of them. More generally, certainly predicting that 2024, when it comes to not only the campaign for the presidency, but also all of these trials, four different criminal trials, other civil trials. E. Jean Carroll has a civil trial, the second portion of her defamation sexual assault trial. That's beginning in January as well. Many other cases around the country going to trial when? Right in the midst of our presidential campaign, right at the time of Super Tuesday, during the course of conventions that are going to be taking place here in the state of Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, the Republicans coming here in July, the Democrats in Chicago, all of that contemporaneous with the administration, the oversight of the rule of law in our courts in 2024. We'll stay on top of all of that. When we come back, we're going to go back to the United States Supreme Court in memory and in hallowed memory of Sandra Day O'Connor. We will talk more about cases pending before the High Court in our final segments here on our Saturday morning broadcast.
Step on up and enjoy what's on tap today. Local talk about the Valley and all of Wisconsin. In fact, it's on tap every day. This is 93.5 The Tap.
CBS News Brief.
U.S. officials from Vice President Kamala Harris to Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin have been urging Israel to avoid civilian casualties in Gaza. How, says South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham on CNN.
I don't know how to do this because Hamas has integrated into the apartments, the schools, and the hospitals. They have tunnels all over the place. The reason so many Palestinians are dying, I think, is because Hamas wants them to die.
At the COP28 climate summit in Dubai, Ari Dasgupta with the World Resources Institute says an immediate plan is needed to combat climate change.
Has to happen. This COP has to deliver for the world a real outcome that gives us trust to the system.
Let's talk about a tricky weather system.
Kind of a combination of the system that's been bringing some heavy rain portions of the Gulf Coast. And then we've also got a system moving across the Great Lakes. So they kind of come together over the Northeast, and that's what's going to bring the snow to northern New England.
Meteorologist Mark Chouinard, CBS News Brief.
A big win for Bucky. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Wisconsin Badgers with a huge win over the Marquette Golden Eagles. The final score 75-64 in favor of Wisconsin. Badgers head coach Greg Gard.
The environment, the atmosphere, the fans were terrific. We kind of envisioned what this team can be.
NBA, the Bucks pulled ahead late to beat the Atlanta Falcons. 132-121. A big night for the Bucks' Cam Payne, who scored a season high 18 points in the win.
Finally got one in front of the fans. I appreciate the support. Man, but I'm going to keep bringing that energy. Y'all keep bringing that energy, man, and we're going to keep getting wins.
Sunday night football at Lambeau Field. Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes on the Packers and Jordan Love.
Jordan's gotten better and better every single game. He's always had the talent. So you can see how much more comfortable he's getting, and their defense can play. They got a lot of guys that can play football. We have to try to match that confidence and find a way to win a football game.
That's Patrick Mahomes with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. No chances for today should be light. Could have a little bit of light rain mixed in with it as well. Any kind of accumulation, if you see it, will be well under an inch. Clouds at upper 30s later in the afternoon. For the overnight, mostly cloudy and upper 20s. It's 33 at our studios.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Timeout.
Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
I was proud to be a soldier.
I told the truth and got kicked out.
And so I thought to myself, I'm taking this rule down.
If you're an LGBTQ plus veteran, your memories are important too. Share your story with the Library of Congress Veterans History Project, where firsthand accounts from U.S. military veterans are preserved and made accessible for researchers and future generations. Visit loc.gov/vets to submit your stories, photographs, and documents today.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
From Lake Wissota State Park and the Pablo Center, the entire Chippewa Valley is tapping in to the station talking about your hometown. 93.5, The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. Okay.
are back here on our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for joining my wonderful producer, Greg. Together, we're presenting this program to you about law, justice, and the aspiration for justice in America. Focusing a lot on government, a lot of courts this week, as we always do. And in that connection, let's return to things before the United States Supreme Court, not only in reverent memory of Sandra Day O'Connor, but also understanding the legacy and the possibility, what has happened historically to that legacy over time when new justices take the place of justices of the past, and the importance of understanding the through lines, if you will, of history when it comes to judicial doctrines. In the past, we have talked a lot about some of the major cases pending before the Supreme Court, and this morning is no exception. We're going to do a couple of different things. We're going to be talking about what's been on the docket, what is going to be on the docket of the Supreme Court just this coming week. So you can tune in for those live arguments. You can go back online, pull up the actual oral arguments of the justices with the lawyers who are appearing in front of them. I'll tell you more about the cases coming up just this past week. And I'm going to spend some time talking and focusing in particular upon a major oral argument that they had, the Supreme Court justices entertained just this past Wednesday, the 29th, in a case called SEC versus Jarchese, going to whether or not the Securities and Exchange Commission itself is constitutional. That may sound like a very academic issue, and in some ways it is, but in other ways, in combination with two other cases also pending before the Supreme Court, is a part of a focus of this Supreme Court on our administrative agencies, their legitimacy writ large, whether or not the system of government that calls upon experts inside our administrative agencies to make judgment calls and to make decisions about things that they know about, whether that entire system should be thrown back, should be withdrawn. And in particular, where the thing called the Chevron Doctrine that permits and actually even directs that courts defer to the wisdom of scientists and mathematicians and medical people and educators and bankers and financial people and sometimes even lawyers, certainly everybody, artists in our community, that deference should no longer be out there as a part of our system. In the present campaign, an awful lot of talk about something called the administrative state and this notion that somehow the administrative state, which actually keeps our government functioning and keeps us not only responsive to the world in which we live, but keeps our government responsive to that, whether that should all be withdrawn, an awful lot of attack, if you will, upon the way in which government works today. And some of that seen just this past Wednesday in an oral argument in this SEC versus Jarchese case, about which we will talk in just a few moments. Let me tell you a little bit about where the Supreme Court is today. Every single year, every single term, this is the 2023-2024 term, begun in early October, finishing on September 30th of next year, but probably all of these major decisions being issued in May, maybe June of the coming year, all of those numbering somewhere around 60, maybe 70 cases in recent years. Just this past term, just about 60 cases. Right now, as of this morning, the Supreme Court has granted cert or certiorari, which is his Latin phrase, the writ, basically commanding a lower court to send up the materials. It's their decision to review a lower court decision. The writs of certiorari having been granted in 46 cases, jumped a little bit just this past week from 44 just this past year, and probably another 15, maybe 20 more cases going to be on the docket before the Supreme Court is done addressing all the cases that it will address in this term. And sure enough, among those additional cases that it placed on its docket for review this coming term, finally is one from our own circuit, the United States Court of Appeals from the Seventh Circuit. Up to now, no cases coming up from the Seventh Circuit. That changed this past week in a case called Erlinger, E-R-L-I-N-G-E-R versus the United States. For the first time, the Supreme Court taking up a case under something called the Armed Career Criminal Act. Spent a lot of time as a prosecutor applying, talking with both defense counsel and certainly investigators, agents, and especially judges about the implications of the Armed Career Criminal Act And the question in particular here, which we'll talk about down the road, this Seventh Circuit case now before the Supreme Court, is whether the Constitution requires a jury trial and proof beyond a reasonable doubt to find that a defendant's prior convictions, the prior convictions of a defendant, were committed on occasions different from one another. In other words, different discrete events. What does the law say about that? And if there's an enhanced penalty imposed under the Armed Career Criminal Act, does a jury have to decide that? What about that issue? That's pending before the Supreme Court now, coming out of our own Seventh Circuit for decision, probably again in May, June, maybe even July of next year. A couple of other things you can anticipate coming up in this coming week. Mark your calendars. Those of you who are not only available while the oral arguments are going on live, those of you who, when you come back from work, come back from your events with your family, other activities of your lives, can also pull these up on the Supreme Court website as well. Three different cases coming up for oral argument this coming week, the 4th, the 5th, and the 6th. Let me tell you just a little bit about them, because it underscores, again, the significance of all these kinds of things the Supreme Court is addressing that do affect our lives. Not going to spend a lot of time discussing the merits of those this morning, but simply to alert you that on the 4th, that is Monday, coming up in just a couple of days, Supreme Court hearing a case, oral argument called Harrington versus Purdue Pharma. And yes, indeed, this is the opioid epidemic case having to do with the Sackler family and opioids coming out of that operation. You know, well, the question here is just this. Chapter 11, which is the organization proceedings in a bankruptcy court, a federal appellate court in reviewing a decision by a bankruptcy court to reorganize Purdue Pharma in the wake of this opioid crisis and the catastrophic impact that the Sackler family had in placing these opioids in our national population. Seeking reorganization, the bankruptcy court reorganized Purdue Pharma in such a way that not only did it reconstitute the organization, but also significantly protected the debtor here, which is Purdue Pharma, from claims brought by people who are still seeking remedies for that opioid distribution. The question is, does a bankruptcy court have the authority to approve a business reorganization plan for a company that shields that company from lawsuits for its role in the opioid epidemic? Fascinating case, important case, having to do with Purdue Pharma, the Sackler family, and the opioid epidemic that, as we know, continues to ravage our nation. That's on Monday. On Tuesday of this coming week, a case called Moore versus the United States. Perhaps a little bit less interesting topically, but still very important. Case called Moore versus the United States. The case concerns the 16th Amendment to the Constitution and Congress's authority to tax sums of money without apportionment among the states. Well, the 16th Amendment authorizes Congress to tax what are called unrealized sums of money without apportionment among the states. That's coming up on Tuesday. That's Moore versus the United States. And then on Wednesday, and this will be the last oral argument before the holidays, before the Supreme Court takes a brief break until coming back in mid-January. But on Wednesday, December 6th, another fascinating case that, again, not a criminal case, but a fascinating case having to do with employment discrimination. This one's called Muldrow versus City of St. Louis. It's being argued on December 6th, which, again, this coming Wednesday. The question there is, does Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which is this omnibus statute that prohibits employment discrimination based upon immutable characteristics. You can't discriminate, America, again, not only under the Constitution, equal protection, due process, all of those kinds of fundamental notions, but codified then by our Congress in Title VII that says you cannot discriminate hiring, firing, terms and conditions of employment based upon immutable characteristics, including sex, including race, national origin, ability, disability, orientation, gender identity, familial status, all kinds of immutable characteristics out there. The question is, does Title VII prohibit discrimination claims going forward as to all terms and conditions of employment, or only those that cause demonstrable, clear, credible, material disadvantages for the employees who are seeking redress? How does this come about? Well, it turns out that in a claim of gender discrimination by a female police officer. An assignment of her, she's transferred between law enforcement units. And that transfer is one to which she objects, not because it results in a reduction in her wages, not because it results in any purely adverse consequences, but rather it is a change that she does not prefer. The question is, without that demonstrable material disadvantage for her and those kinds of very credible things, do the other damages that she maintains apply to her that were visited upon her? Is that the kind of thing that Title VII also prohibits? An interesting question about the breadth, the scope of Title VII, again, having to do with a law enforcement officer, but plainly applicable across the board. Depending upon what the Supreme Court does, again, probably May or June, in Muldrow versus City of St. Louis being argued this coming Wednesday. Three cases coming up for determination very, very soon and in the term of the Supreme Court. I indicated last week that just this past week, we did have other cases argued before the Supreme Court. One of those called Brown versus U.S., Jackson versus U.S., again, having to do with the Armed Career Criminal Act. That was on Monday. Again, what a serious drug offense is all about. On Tuesday, we had a case called McElrath versus Georgia, a fascinating double jeopardy case that focuses on whether or not a second prosecution, a criminal prosecution, can happen in the state of Georgia after a jury there returns what everybody acknowledges is an inconsistent verdict. On the one hand, finding the defendant not guilty by reason of insanity. In another case, finding him guilty by reason of having committed the event in a sane condition. It's called an irreconcilable verdict. And the case coming up from the Georgia Supreme Court, whether or not double jeopardy prevents the state of Georgia from prosecuting the defendant a second time for that case, for that prosecution unit for which he was acquitted. Or does the entire verdict get thrown out and the prosecutors get to start over all over again? That case was argued on Tuesday, McElrath versus Georgia, also along with a second case coming out, not of Georgia, but of the Third Circuit, called Wilkinson versus Garland, an agency determination. Again, this gets us into the big case from just this past week, an agency determination that a given set of facts rises to the level of exceptional and extremely unusual hardship. Whether that's a mixed question of law and fact, how do you determine that? What about discretionary judgments? Again, looking at what agencies do in determining mixed issues of law and fact and hardship, in that case called Wilkinson versus Garland, all sounding very academic, but important, as is this major case. It was also argued on Wednesday, the 29th, SEC versus Jarchese. Let's talk about that right now, because once again, it falls among the category of three different cases before the Supreme Court in this term, in which the Supreme Court is addressing this larger issue of the legitimacy of the administrative state, those words in quotes, the administrative actions of our many agencies in the federal government. We know from our previous discussions that the Supreme Court, on its very first day, entertained oral argument involving the legitimacy of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, this agency identified and organized by Congress to protect small lenders, small debtors, if you will, getting loans from lenders. And along the way, a challenge to the CFPB on the basis that it doesn't get funding directly from the Congress, but in fact gets funding through the Federal Reserve, whether that funding line, not through the Congress, not through the appropriations process under the Constitution, but rather through fees and other assessments made by the Federal Reserve, an indirect funding source, renders the CFPB unconstitutional and should be shut down in place ever since 2008. Supreme Court at that time, early part of its term in October, probably disinclined to agree with the petitioners who say that the CFPB should be shut down. But nonetheless, it's out there. The larger issue that's going to be coming up again in mid-January when the Congress and the Supreme Court come back, all of them on Capitol Hill, January 17th. The Supreme Court is going to be issuing or entertaining oral argument in a case that we're going to talk about right after this break here on our morning broadcast.
You're listening to 93.5, The Tap.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way
to get inside
each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Think you'd like working with us at Civic Media? We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. If you have the right skills to join our team, let's talk. Civic Media is a proud equal opportunity employer committed to diversity and inclusion, along with the growth and development of all current and future employees. If you're interested or are part of an organization who wants to know more, go to our website, civicmedia.us, and click on the Careers tab.
93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
And we are back for this, our final segment here in our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you for joining my terrific producer, Greg, and me for our discussion this morning. As always, appreciate your, not only your attention, your focus, your listening focus on our discussion, but as is the case every Saturday morning, your questions and your comments. A brief programming note also as we go into this, our final minutes. Next Saturday, December 9th, our 75th broadcast here on the radio broadcast stations of Civic Media, a special focus on what I'm calling the future of America, focusing on promises made by a presidential campaign right now about what happens if indeed this particular campaign is successful in retaking the White House. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about the rule of law implications when it comes to a lot of the discussion in our public domain right now in the campaign process. What if these things that campaign advocates for the presidency, what if they come true? And talking about the future of America, talking about the future of America next Saturday in a major, significant, spending a lot of time contributing to the public discussion about not only the campaign, but also that viewed through a rule of law, a justice, a government lens, if you will. What can and can you not do as a president of the United States of America? We know that the Supreme Court, again, is going to be entertaining similarly important questions coming up in January. I mentioned right before the break that on January 17th, it is going to be entertaining oral argument in a major case called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. And the question there, a huge question, one of the major cases pending before the Supreme Court, arguably the most important of all, should a longstanding principle of judicial deference to the experts who reside and interpret the law inside our federal agencies in situations when the law is not clear, should that deference be abandoned? It's called Chevron deference. And it comes up in a case called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, another related case. We're going to talk more about that in January. But it brings us finally to our discussion of this major oral argument of just this past Wednesday in SEC versus Jarchese. And this case, again, falls among the category of these three cases that address whether or not our administrative agencies are legitimate. Mr. Jarchese himself finding himself on the receiving end of some significant penalties, about $300,000 or so, for his mismanagement of some $24 million in hedge funds. And the SEC launched an administrative investigation of him. And the agency fined Mr. Jarchese, again, $300,000, barred him from participation in the securities industry, ordered him to give up nearly $685,000 in unlawful gains. That's what they did as a result of the administrative function of the SEC. Now, Mr. Jarchese, not happy with that result, not only came back and said no basis for the SEC, these administrators, these security folks inside the SEC to do this, but also attacking the SEC itself and saying that for the past 90 years, almost an entire century, the SEC itself has been operating unconstitutionally. And in particular, he has said a number of things. That way back in 1934, when the SEC was first constituted, Congress failed to give it clear marching orders with respect to what it's supposed to do. Now, they did commission it legislatively, but plainly could not envision what would happen over the period of years, 100 years of administrative oversight. He says that the Congress failed to give them the significant amount of direction, and for that reason, the agency has unconstitutionally been operating for the last 9 decades. He also says that this particular agency is not sufficiently tethered to another issue, which we're going to talk about next Saturday when it comes to the presidency and the role of the presidency when it comes to our administrative agencies, this administrative state concept. He says, because the SEC is not sufficiently tethered to the White House, to the executive branch, likewise, for that reason, it is unconstitutional. But most significant, and the thing that the Supreme Court focused on principally just this past week, was this claim that under the 7th Amendment to the Constitution, Mr. Jarchese and everybody who appears in front of the SEC is entitled to a jury trial for the kinds of things that the SEC was imposing upon him. Never done in 90 years, and prompting Elena Kagan, among others, to say, you must be joking. You're coming now and you're alleging that the SEC is unconstitutional because it has not granted you this right that has not been acknowledged by the Supreme Court in the past, not a part of the legislature for 90 years. And the attorney for Mr. Jarchese says, yes, it hasn't been thought of before. And Elena Kagan comes back in one of the most notable exchanges of the oral argument. She says, that's chutzpah. That's chutzpah to come before this court and to maintain that. However, Elena Kagan, plainly not in the majority of the Supreme Court justices entertaining oral argument on the Jarchese case just this past week. A majority of the court seeming, again, reading the tea leaves, we don't know for sure, but seeming to suggest that indeed Mr. Jarchese and others do in fact have a Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial for all of the administrative decisions made by SEC officials as a part of it, their administrative function commissioned by the Congress for the past 100 years or so. Many members of the Supreme Court quizzing both the government, or the Solicitor General, and also Mr. Jarchese's attorneys on why it is that this something of this significance, a decision by an agency to impose these fines, to fine him, to bar him from future securities engagements, should not be subject to a Seventh Amendment jury trial. Again, if they go down that road and find that indeed the SEC needs to afford individuals this kind of due process at that level, a huge change, a huge attack, if you will, an amendment to the way that the SEC does its work on a regular basis, has implications of a huge collateral nature, not just upon the SEC, but upon many other agencies. And that's why this case is so incredibly important. The SEC looking to it, going to be looking very closely at what the Supreme Court says about this jury trial issue in May or June. But beyond that, we all look in connection with the Jarchese matter, in connection with the CFPB case, and indeed in connection with the Raimondo case having to do with whether or not judicial deference should be supported. All of that plainly a focus of this United States Supreme Court in this term. When we come back again next Saturday, a great deal of focus upon the interplay between agencies and upon the executive branch, talking about promises made by candidates in the presidential campaign. Join us next Saturday again here on our morning broadcast for that discussion. In the meantime, have a good week, everybody.
Tell a friend what's on tap.
There's a new station in town with conversation about Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley.
This is 93.5 The Tap. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy. planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe. And is the best way to protect that legacy?
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Your hometown radio refreshed. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Steel.
I'm Linda Kenyon.